This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your shining blue moon of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
She said, I've seen you in here before. I said, I've been here a time or two. She said, hello, my name is Bobby Joe.
If you know that song, coming in at the top, first of all, we were listening to As Good As I Once Was. That is Toby Keith. We are talking about Toby, and Toby passed away a couple weeks ago. He'd been suffering from stomach cancer for a couple years. Toby Keith was a very prominent figure in country music, particularly in the late 90s into the mid 2000s. Toby was also, for some, a very problematic figure in terms of how he leaned into jingoism and other things during that time period. But Toby Keith had a very long career. And one thing that I'm hoping to do in this episode is talk about that challenging time period, but also contextualize it as part of a larger conversation about his particular stripe of masculinity and masculine expression in country. There was a lot of writing about Toby in the wake of his passing, a lot of it very focused on his political, you can say, ideology or at least expression, especially during the post 9/11 period. But again, there was a lot more to Toby, and I wanted to get into that with someone who has been writing about country music for a very long time and sees the big picture. So David Cantwell is here. David, first time on podcast, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So David recently wrote a very good book about Haggard. I am also, and I held this up to you before, I am very up on this book, which is Heartaches by the Number, Country Music's 500 Greatest Singles. Also, this little pamphlet on George Strait, which I have not yet read. But I'm happy to have.
Don't recommend it.
Look, we all have those. we all have those. David, you wrote in your Substack a very thorough piece that I thought really covered all the bases on Toby. And I also wrote something, and I felt that immediate challenge of how do you situate him, not simply in his political moment, but also we're at a very different political moment right now, both in the country and also in country music. You pointed out just before we started recording what's happening with Beyonce right now. You want to talk about that just to set the table for where we're at?
Yeah, Beyonce today became the first Black woman ever to debut at number one on Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart.
Bonkers.
Yeah. And this moment began, this moment when a kind of Black dance country music was emerging, you know, maybe began with Daddy Lessons when she had that and then duetted with it infamously or famously on the award show with the Chicks. And then also Old Town Road followed on the heels of that, was a huge phenomenon, was briefly on the country charts, and they pulled it off. And so the difference this time is that they're working at the country radio, and it's being picked up at least on some stations around the country. And of course, streaming is now figured into how all of that is tabulated. And as a result, she's number one. And so a lot of us are just ecstatic about that, but also very curious to see like what happens next. Does this have any consequences, or is it just she'll have a hit and then we'll be back where we were?
Right. Or maybe she'll have three hits. Who knows?
Also,
One thing I saw in some of the coverage of the song, I think it's Texas Hold'em, which seems to be the one that's doing the most. Texas Hold'em being serviced to country radio is that iHeartRadio, which is obviously a conglomerate with loads of stations, made a position to program it, to playlist it on their country stations. And so that alone, whether or not independent stations pick it up, whether or not small or mid-market stations pick it up, it's going to be getting spins. It's going to be in media base. It's going to be in all the places that have historically been hostile to Black country performers.
I really have my fingers crossed that it's not just her celebrity that has gotten it there, but that it opens up a new sonic space. Because one of those record exec or radio execs that was commenting on it and embracing it said something along the lines of having Beyonce in the format is such a new and exciting area for us to explore. And I was like, Tanner Adele,
oh, yeah,
who made my country album of the year last year.
Well, it was on my top 20 list last year. Yeah.
She's great standing record. Right there.
Yeah. Great record.
She's the Beyonce with the lasso. And Raina Roberts is doing that same kind of dance thing that's or akin to what Beyonce is doing with Texas Hold'em. And my favorite country album 2 years ago, I think, was Nelly's album Heartland, where he duets on High Horse with Breland. So in a sense, since Daddy Lessons, Beyonce is playing catch up with what other Black country artists have been playing around with. And so I hope she's clearly leapfrogged them. And I hope that the consequence is that she drags those kinds of artists along with her.
Yeah, I mean, we don't yet know about other collaborators on the record. Obviously, Rhiannon Giddens was playing on one of these songs, but we'd also don't know, you know, maybe Breland's got a writing credit. Maybe Dalton Dover's in there somewhere. Like, who knows? There's a lot of opportunity.
It's an exciting time. I've been saying for a while now that this is, in terms of just how much the quantity of quality country music is as good now, maybe as ever. I'm a homer for the early 70s country stuff, but I think this is as good as that has been. And I just am. So I'm hoping this leads us to a moment where we get more people of color, more artists of color in the format. We get more women generally in the format, but also more sonic diversity within the format. I'm a big tent guy. I want all the country that there is there on the radio next to each other and more generational diversity, which is one something that people don't mention very much. I want the old, I want Tanya Tucker followed by Beyonce with Luke Combs covering Tracy Chapman or maybe Tracy Chapman. So it's an exciting moment. And then the final thing I'll say about that is the industry needs to change, not just with its face and with its voices, but behind the scenes too. We need more Black record producers and engineers and more session players and tour people and PR people and record executives. It needs to be systemic change. Country has a chance to have its reconstruction finally. And so we'll see what happens.
Well, it's interesting that this Beyonce thing is happening in this specific moment, because I wonder, does it play a little different? Does it feel a little different? Does it feel even maybe a little more necessary in the wake of what happened last year with Jason Aldean and some of the resurgent politically right-wing energy that I don't think overtook the genre, but certainly had a moment during the summer of like marking its stamp? Do you feel that there's something either well-timed or poignant, or maybe even that the genre is trying to demonstrate we are not that? Like, that's here, it's in the building, it's part, but actually we'd love to do something proactive to demonstrate that's not at the center.
I don't think that. I don't think the industry is trying to be proactive. I'm thinking that they have this opportunity thrust upon them, and they also, they're interested in the bottom line, and they know they're going to cash in on this moment, at least. They were cashing in on the other one, and that's fine for them.
Right, they're both cash-in moments.
Yes. And so the political part of it, that's harder for me to judge. But I do think you're right that this is, if not an explicit, certainly an implicit rebuttal to what was going on last summer. And the Jason Aldean, Try That in a Small Town, and the Oliver Anthony, Richmond, North of Richmond.
To be fair, I find that to be a more nebulous, politically nebulous song than the Aldean song.
Well, since we're talking about race and country music, I think that picking Richmond, the former capital of the Confederacy, is not a coincidence. As I wrote at the time, it's like rich folk north of Norfolk was right there. They could have done that instead. But all of that stuff gets us, I think, takes us back to Toby Keith, because Keith gets us to that stuff.
I wonder, so as we were going through that moment last summer, in what ways did it echo the immediate post 9/11 Toby Keith, and even by extension, Daryl Worley and Alan Jackson's anthems and all these songs from like late 01 into 02? A lot of solemnity, a lot of military families and videos. I remember it very clearly, country really taking on the mantle of patriotism and of creative patriotism or patriotic creativity. I want, to me, the two moments obviously echo each other, but felt slightly different. But I wonder how you thought those two moments spoke to each other as we were going through it last year.
People may forget, you don't forget, but people may forget that after Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue, The Angry American, he also had Beer for My Horses. And that to me is the more direct connection to try that in a small town, because they both seem to be championing, threatening vigilante violence. Keith's Beer for My Horses was remembering the good old days when there were lynch parties for bad people. And then you went back to the bar and had an after party and celebrated with Beer for My Horses and Whiskey for My Men, and as if this were a good thing. And so that's what I thought of with Try That in a Small Town, which is it's the same kind of thing. If you come in here and do something bad, we're going to not just put a boot in your ass, but string you up. That's the immediate connection I had with it. And then that small town video, Try That in a Small Town video, was shot in front of that Tennessee courthouse where there had actually been a lynching in the past. But I give him Aldean a pass on that. He probably didn't know that simply because he should have done a Google on that. But what it actually prompted me to think about, the imagery of that White House looking building, was the insurrection on January 6th. And again, that's a Keith connection, because he performed at one of the events surrounding Trump's inaugural.
When I think about the way that Aldean has largely chosen to express his politics, a lot of Aldean's politics were expressed, I thought, extra musically, social media, through his wife, and so on. And he only has occasionally dipped into what ended up being Try That in a Small Town. Toby, I think, maybe inverted in a way, was very direct about politics in music, but maybe had a slightly fuzzier relationship to politics outside of music. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because one of the things that comes up over and again, and it's a little hackneyed at this point, for many years he was a registered Democrat, eventually re-registered as an independent, performed for Obama's Nobel Prize ceremony and also at Trump's inauguration, trying to be his version of like a big tent political guy. But I wonder the expediency of taking on the role of jingoist in chief in 2001. What do you think in his mind was the calculation about why that was a good idea? And did you see seeds of that earlier in his career before that was thrust upon him or he jumped towards it?
Yeah, I didn't see seeds of it because they were there to see. If you were a bigger Toby Keith fan than I was and were following him more closely, you probably knew that he already was doing a lot of performing for the troops. That was a big part of his, you know, of his image, but also a commitment he had made long before that moment. His father, of course, that first or second verse of the song is about his father serving and flying a flag, losing an eye. And so he said the initial inspiration for Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue was his father, who had died not long before the 9/11 attacks. When I was getting ready to come on and talk with you, I was looking through a new book. It's not out, forthcoming book, I should say, by Joey Thompson. It's called Cold War Country, and it's all about how the country music industry and the U.S. military have worked closely together for decades. And so he talks about this moment, as you might imagine he would. And one of the things he says is that, which I heard all before, is that he just wrote it for the troops. He had performed it many times, but just for troops, because he thought it was a morale booster. But he was talked into releasing it, according to Thompson's book, by Marine Corps Commandant General James Jones. And so the way he told the story, I thought, was always that friends convinced him, people in the military that were his friends. But no, it was like an actual general or a commandant general.
It was an order.
Yes. Yeah, that's one way to put it. Yes. And so that was what led him to release the song. He thought that it would have some backlash to it. And I think rightly so. What do you think of that song?
As music or as politics?
Well, I think it's hard to separate those two, but you can take them separately if you want.
It was matched to the moment. I remember it being a very uncomfortable moment. And I remember feeling like it was not that different, frankly, in tenor and spirit from a lot of the news coverage that you were getting at that time. You needed, or it was presented as almost like team sports. And this is like a battle anthem or a battle charge for team sports. It just so happened that the team was America. It felt very consistent with how people were talking about American privilege and being on the receiving end of an attack on a particular set of ideology that if you can gain some distance from it, and Times employees aren't supposed to get too deep into politics, personal politics, but you get some distance from it, not everything in that ideology is sterling. And it is premised upon some incredibly difficult and longstanding inequities. It felt like, and when I say the right, I don't mean like in my heart, but it felt like a song that was incredibly matched to the spirit of that moment. Whether the song made the moment or the moment made the song, who can say? People wanted to feel tough after being told that they were not tough. And for this man to say, we'll put a boot in your ass, for a certain type of person who said, that's what I want to feel.
And said, we'll put a boot in your ass. It's the American way. And then on top of that, we'll light up your world like the 4th of July. And it feels like the whole wide world is raining down on you. All of which is just, to me, is definitely, you're right. You're exactly right. That was consistent with the tenor of that moment for many Americans. It was a mainstream sentiment. But it also, it just strikes me as so proven you're tough. Is a good way to put it. And it makes sense that his next record was Beer for My Horses. And he has so many songs like that. It's like, it's almost like he sees the world. Well, he even says a sucker punch from somewhere in the back, right? It's like, it's not an actual geopolitical conflict in the song. It's like a bar fight. Like you said, I wrote a book about Merle Haggard, The Running Kind. And his corollary here is a song called The Fight Inside of Me. And those songs seem so different to me, in that The Fight Inside of Me is about is literally about arguing with people who think we shouldn't be over there fighting in Vietnam. And he takes it, like a lot of Americans did at the time, as the consensus that, of course, we should. We must stop communism. And so if you don't love it, leave it, and all that kind of stuff. But it's an argument. Even the Fight Inside of Me part is like a fight you would have with your uncle at Thanksgiving. It's that kind of an argument. And Keith is taking it to a very different place, right? There's no argument. It's just kicking ass. And I find that I find it childish and unhelpful and all these kinds of things, that while at the same time recognizing that's where people were at. The U.S. of A. 'Cause we'll put a boot in your ass. It's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam. Your name at the top of his list, and a Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
When I talk about whether you see seeds or indications that he would be the guy, because someone was going to be the person, someone, and who's to say who, he's the person, right? When I think of 90s Toby Keith, it's funny because one of the things that I was writing about after his passing was, to me, Toby Keith is like a comedian of like masculine theater. Like, he's a performer who, like, on the outside, he's a big brawny guy. He's singing about you should have been a cowboy. He's like singing to women in this like seemingly parodic, dismissive way. And you can read him literally, but I often find a lot of his stuff, especially in that era, to really be about the frailty, to be about, I know I'm puffing my chest. There's songs that are like, they're winking. And that's, it's funny because like, I found Toby, like, how do you like me now is, depending how you look at it, either a super tough guy, like, I'm on top and I left you behind. Or it's like, I still want to impress you. I wish you would look at me. And I was, before 9/11 and before those songs, I was sympathetic to this kind of conflicted masculine character. I thought it was an interesting ongoing character study of how like men in country should behave. I wonder how that strikes you. I know that's not a universal read that everybody sees it that way, but that's always how it felt to me.
That's definitely true, that his blustery masculine theater, that's an excellent way to put it. I always feel like in those songs that there's definitely a sense of play, a self-deprecation, a wink, like you say. But I also feel like he always lands at a spot where he doesn't. There's never a reversal in those songs. There's never a place where you thought I was a big blustery guy, but now it turns out I'm a frail, tender guy. It's that part is all subtext. And he tends to land on like a later song that's in the same vein, though, is As Good As I Once Was, where he gets the joke about getting older and about how he used to be able, he could handle two women, but now he's not going to be so good, but he's as good now as he ever was. But where he lands is he's still pretty good. So that's the thing, that he gets to have it both ways. He gets to sort of do the parody, but also embrace it, I think, in ways that are more complex than those songs would seem to appear.
To me, when I think about what 9/11 did to Toby Keith, is it, for at least a period of time, stripped him of that nuance, whether he voluntarily put it to the side or whether he audience demand and also like the demands of the country, as it were imposed upon him. But it does seem to have stripped him a little of that nuance. Although I wonder, like, to me, when I think of like the Taliban song, which is like, the more I was listening to it after he passed, I was like, this is like a Jimmy Buffett record, weirdly. But also it's like, this is dark, like this. You shouldn't make records like this. Like, you could never do a record like this in 2024. Like, absolutely not. 1,000% no. So there was like he was like a little bit like, but what if I made it a little bit this way? But I think people were not into that. I think they just wanted the big anthems, the big tank anthems.
As I was going back through it, it struck me that, so Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue comes out, and that's all boot in your ass. But a legit, especially someone like him who had a father in the military and who had close ties to the military, surely he got to a place where he was saying, it's not a big fun bar fight. People die. Americans are going to die. And so then you get American Soldier, which is trying, I think, to say, to add a nuance to the previous work. And the Taliban song is somebody that's actually trying, is a song that at least is attempting to say that a normal person living in Afghanistan does not enjoy this. But somehow that gets played for laughs, which just seems like the wrong, not reading the room.
Because it's written from the perspective of the people who are bombing, basically. It's written from the imperialist perspective. So, but I agree, but I remember for all its flaws, I do remember feeling the same way that you're describing about that song, which is like, this is an attempt at injecting some kind of humanity into a conversation that lacks nuance altogether, certainly through the dominant media of the day. And American Soldier, a very uncomplicated moment in American. And I remember, like, I think I wrote something in like 04, maybe for Salon. I mean, Salon still exists. I don't know, about like weeping soldiers in country music videos. There were just like a spate of them. There was like a Gary Allen video where there was like a reunited military family. And I wonder how much this is touched on in that book that you're describing. Like, I wonder how much of that is the military proactively saying, we need to essentially do like PR and image repair, and what better venue for that than country music videos? I wonder about that. Maybe it's in the book.
I shouldn't say definitively, but I don't think it is. It spends most of its time up through the 80s. And then it just ends with a 9/11 era coda, is my understanding of it. But I guarantee everyone should read it. Don't take my word for what it covers. It's The Cold War Country by Joseph Thompson.
Let me ask this, though. Do you feel that there was I feel that something was lost or taken or removed from the Toby Keith proposition during that 2001 to 2003 period, let's say? You do have the winking Taliban song. You do have Beer from My Horses, which is a Willie Nelson duet, but also talks about vigilante violence there. But it's a more complicated, it's a more textured song than, say, American Soldier. Do you think that Toby left something behind and said, I am now this person? It's either an opportunity, or it's how I feel, or it's the most potent art I can make right now. And I'll just leave the kind of like the blustery, I'm looking at a singles list. Who's that man? I'm leaving Who's That Man behind.
Yeah. Well, some of those early ones, Who's That Man is a good example. Upstairs Downtown, about a young girl who leaves home at 18 and moves to the city and then comes back home. Of course she does. It's a country song, but that's quite touching. I think my favorite of his is I Love This Bar.
Incredible. An incredible record.
And I think that a lot of his, that reminds me of Bobby Bear. And Bobby Bear, one of the reasons why I like that is because he doesn't necessarily come off as even a blowhard in that one. He just comes off as a guy that enjoys this bar. And coming after, I think that's on the Shock and Y'all album, which is after.
Yeah, same album that American Soldier's on.
Right. And so I think this is, I Love This Bar. It's a bar that has rich people and poor people and bikers and yuppies. And I think it's supposed, right? The bar is.
It's America, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I find that it's limited. Apparently all the people there are white. He doesn't mention that, but I assume they are. But I find that pretty powerful.
Yeah, he's doing PR for him. Like, to me, I Love This Bar is of a piece with American Soldier. They're both about the power of the American idea to the extent that one is allowed to believe in that. I Love This Bar is him saying, theoretically, everyone is welcome. Of course, we know that's not actually true, but that's the idea that he was putting out there. An American Soldier is that idea is worth protecting, even if lives are lost. Those two songs talk to each other in my mind.
Yeah, that's smart. My other favorites: She Never Cried in Front of Me, Upstairs Downtown, I mentioned, Who's That Man, Country Comes to Town is one that I like. It's a standard country meme, almost. The country kid goes to town and tears it up. A Little Too Late is one that I especially like. I'm not even sure if that was a single, but it sounds like a Dwight Yoakam or Mavericks record with strings and stuff. It shows him off as a singer in a way that, especially after 9/11, he didn't do as much. He did more of the shouting stuff. But in terms of like what he left behind, I think he left behind the nuance that we've talked about, and he leaned into novelty is probably too hard a stance to take on what he did. But I think a lot of it is that.
You mean post that period?
Yes. Yes.
I do think like sometime in the 2010s, he recovered some of the voice. Like it's almost like 10 years had passed. 10 years had passed. And he's like, I don't have to do that thing anymore.
Don't Let the Old Man Come In is an opportunity to sing very quietly that he rarely gave himself. And you're exactly right that that's a really powerful, but that's at a period when he's not making hits anymore, really.
Right. And it's like, it's often you're doing brand management at that point with a little bit of like 10 for them, one for me. The songs that have always stood out, we've talked about a few of them. As Good As I Once Was is, I feel like I could write 100,000 words on As Good As I Once Was. Just like a phenomenal song about what it's like at the first moment when you realize that everything that you used to perceive as strength has actually been sapped away from you. Just a spectacular record. How Do You Like Me Now, which is again like the sort of photo negative of that record, which is just like, you thought I was weak, but actually, I mean, obviously, How Do You Like Me Now comes first. He had to be strong before he was weak. I like the early, I like Who's That Man. I like the kind of, I made a reference to Does That Blue Moon Ever Shine on You? I like that. It's funny because you read some of the Toby Keith interviews and he talks about the first few albums and saying, like, basically before he got to the DreamWorks period, he's like, I was singing what they told me to sing, or I didn't have as much control. Okay, I buy it, but also a lot of this stuff's very good, I think. It's probably a little too, it's a little straight, no pun intended. It's a little straight for him, but they are good. He is a legitimately good singer. He has nuance in his voice, and he has complication in his tone and in his lyric. So I always found those romantic songs, frankly, pretty convincing. Obviously, look, you literally wrote the book on Haggard. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, when you look at Toby Keith's antecedents, who set the table for what Toby ended up being able to deliver in your mind? And how much of that is the Haggard strain and how much of it is coming from somewhere else?
When Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue came out with We'll Light Up Your World Like the 4th of July, I was trying to think of like antecedents for that. Like in the moment, I remember thinking about this. And the one obvious antecedent is Red Foley in 1944, back in World War II, had a number one hit with a song called Smoke on the Water. And it included the lines, "There'll be nothing left but vultures to inhabit all that land when our modern ships and bombers make a graveyard of Japan." Which sort of meets Toby head on there. The next year, Bob Wills covered the song, but left out that verse, I think mainly so that they could add an extra pedal steel guitar solo for Dancers.
It's reminding me of something, some stuff in this book. You know this one? So this is Country Music Goes to War. This is an edited anthology by Charles Wolfe and James Akinson. Came out maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago. I don't know, a while
ago. At least. Yeah, yeah.
2004, sorry, 20. Let's not talk about how old we're getting. Came out 20 years ago. But it reminds me of some of the things talked about in this book.
Yeah, that's an excellent book to pick up.
Good compendium stuff.
Well, since you mentioned, let's not talk about how old we're getting, I'll just cop. One of the things about Keith's death that hit home with me in particular is because we're the same age, he and I. He was like maybe 5 months older than me. So it's too soon. Even if you want to like sit the guy down and shake him by his collar and say, "Stop this," you still know. I would like you to still be around making records.
For there is a great destroyer made of fire and flesh and steel, rolling toward the foes of freedom. They'll go down beneath its wheels. There'll be nothing left but vultures to inhabit all that land when our modern ships and bombers make a graveyard of Japan. There'll be smoke.
You talked about his later career being a little bit more novelty, but I also wondered if, when I thought about those records, and I'm talking Red Solo Cup, what are we talking about? I Like Girls That Drink Beer, Drunk Americans, like something like this. I wondered if on some level it wasn't, corrective is a really strong word, but is it kind of like the warrior in repose, kind of saying, I don't need to fight that fight anymore. You know, I've earned the right to smoke weed with Willie and sing about just beer, like not unironically sing about beer, like or uncomplicatedly. Did you ever feel like as his 2010s work, did that ever strike you like that?
Not really. I mean, I'm not saying that what you're saying isn't true, but it was, I guess what I'm saying is that maybe it did strike me that way, but I wasn't interested in it. You know, I'd heard him do other things. Some of it I hated and some of it I was quite fond of. In a lot of his numbers, I really feel like he strikes a Bobby Bear tone. And Bobby Bear does like Marie Laveau, if you know that one, or his song The Winner, right? Where he has this, he's a lot like Toby Keith Bear is in those songs, where he's like the loudest guy in the bar. He's a blowhard with a heart of gold. He's the guy that will, he's the loudest, but he's also the one that will lug over two extra chairs to the table so you can sit with him, right? And that persona, that guy, I hear that more in the early stuff. And the later stuff, I just hear the blowhard. And that may be a limitation of my listening skills.
I also think like one of the instructive things, not simply about the coverage of Toby after his passing, but really after how a lot of once controversial or people who had a particularly loud moment in the spotlight for one reason or another, discourse can often be constrained about figures like that. And as I said at the beginning, obviously in the wake of his passing, there's a tremendous amount of focus on the work that he did in a 2-year time period that was very loud, very commercially successful, and really emblematic of the state of the country at that moment. When you think of the bigger picture of Keith's career, do you think that the work of those 2 years was so loud that it destabilizes any understanding or appreciation of the other work that he had done? Because this is something that I feel like the internet was reckoning with in real time.
That's definitely the case. You had asked me about Haggard before as an antecedent. And so some of the ways that he's different, right, then Haggard evolved over the course of his career. He was certainly associated with hippie bashing and stuff like that, with Fight Inside of Me and pro-war. But he eventually looked back to that particular song and said, you know what? I was as dumb as a rock when I wrote that song. And in fact, the week of 9/11, this is how I opened my Haggard book. The week of 9/11, Haggard played the Thursday after the Tuesday. He played Kansas City. And so I went to the show. And as you can, before he's ever anywhere near the stage, the crowd is inside. And he came out and quieted that. He came out and he started to play Silver Wings. He didn't say a word. He played Silver Wings, Shining in the Sunlight, which was so reminiscent of that Tuesday. And that crowd shut up. He just like brought the room down to where he wanted it. And he still sang Fight Inside of Me. But when he got to it, he did a little speech ahead of it. And he solemnized it as like this thing, like, we're going to have to do this now. He was seeing what was coming and seeing it as a burden, but a necessary one. One rolling up your sleeves to do necessary work. And that is not in Keith's American Soldier gets at some of that, but that is not in Keith's songs at all. And in that way, I think he was an accelerant for a lot of what has come since. I think I hear more of like Hank Jr. in Toby's later stuff than I do Merle's.
Okay, so here's what I would say. I think, and I'm looking at the discography now, even if I find some of the work politically treacherous, the run of albums from How Do You Like Me Now through Shockin' Y'all, those are all at minimum B-plus albums. At minimum, they're all B-plus albums.
Okay.
And now to answer the question about Haggard or the Chicks.
Well, we don't have to do that.
I think it's like an unknowable thing. Also, I think even earlier in his career, I think the problem that Toby Keith was trying to solve was a different problem than Merle was trying to solve, and certainly a different problem than the Chicks were trying to solve. I'm interested, like, I wonder how you think of early Toby or even prime period Toby up against Alan, George, Garth. Because to me, when I'm looking at Toby coming in, what is it, 93 or 94, when he's really arriving, you're right after the class of 88, right? You're right after, whether it's Clint Black or Garth or whatever, and you have country music, Garth in Central Park, arena level. You have Alan doing incredible big shows, doing these really like textured Southern type records. Where do you see Toby sitting in relationship to that class of male singers who really reframed country in like the pop imagination at that time?
He comes into Garth Mania, right? And has an out of the box number one. And then in the entire Garth Shania decade, his Should Have Been a Cowboy is the most played song, is what I kept reading when he died.
Is that true? In the 90s?
In the 90s.
Wow. I didn't even know that. Crazy.
I know. And it's just like, that's pretty impressive. And so the question then is, is he with Garth and Alan? Or is he with Clay Walker or someone like that who had a number of number one hits? Who was very popular.
I would argue closer to Garth and Alan.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think he's closer, but I think he's a level or two down. He's there with Mark Chestnut, maybe, or someone like that, who I am quite fond of.
I am totally fond of Mark Chestnut, but no, sorry. I got a Mark Chestnut t-shirt in the other room. No, but no, not down with Mark Chestnut. No, I don't accept that. I don't accept that.
Ricky Van Shelton.
No. Oh, my God. Absolutely not. No. no, I can't believe this is how this podcast is going. But no, we're not. All right, but let me ask one other question, because this is, so I just asked, in essence, like, where does Toby sit with that ocean of male superstars that he landed in? I'm actually really curious. When we talked about bro country, quote unquote, in the late 2000s into the 2010s, I often think that people fail to make the link between that and the kind of patriotic bluster of a Toby in the early 2000s, making country a safe haven for like untrammeled masculine expression. Now, obviously, plenty of country singers have felt comfortable being uncomplicated anti-woman men in country. It's not novel, but I think the success of Toby Keith during that run is lurking in the back of a lot of that late 2000s, early 2010s stuff.
That's exactly right. And it helps me explain why I don't put him with Garth and Alan and Clint. It's because they're also doing expressions of masculinity, but they allowed themselves unabashed tenderness in some parts of their work. And Keith, particularly once he gets past 9/11 and then doesn't really let himself do that anymore. And that fits right in with the bro that you're pointing to.
Yeah, it always seemed to me that was the DNA, like the DNA bomb of the bro was really in the early 2000s. And ultimately what you ended up seeing, and obviously Aldean being the kind of like ne plus ultra of starting in that moment and then now like arriving at a moment of like political, reactionary political country music. The fascinating thing to me about how bro country moved at that time was there was some small part of it where it was like, hey, we listen to hip hop, like we're a little bit open-minded. But actually the kind of like masculine politics of it were very aggressive and very unsubtle.
The 2000s moment that precedes the bro thing there too is Toby, but also like Big and Rich, who are riding a horse to save a cowboy.
Look, I want to say I spent some time with Big and Rich in the early 2000s. I don't know that I could have called how it went after that. I don't know if I could have called that how John Rich would end up right now. Like it just feels different from what he was talking about in like, when was Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy? When was that, like 03 or 05 or something like that?
05 maybe.
Yeah, like it just wasn't how he was talking. It's changed really radically. But yes, I saw them at CBGB's, if you can imagine that. Big and Rich playing CBGB's. Real time. That's a real thing that happened. Is there a particular underappreciated Toby song you'd like to go out with?
Well, I do like, and again, it's an early one, You Ain't Much Fun Now That I've Gotten Sober. It's like a little boogie-woogie.
Masculinity is complicated, dude.
Right. He's in there. And I like it. Actually, when I was listening again, it reminded me, Brandi Clark has a song about all the stuff she got accomplished while her partner was hungover. And it's like the male version of that, except it's not about doing the chores around the house. It's about having fun.
Also very much of its moment in country music. There's certainly like, I'm sure some Brad Paisley songs that probably are like basically just mirror images of that. Okay, we'll go out on that. That's our show. Thank you to David Cantwell for coming through. I appreciate you talking through this fraught territory. Very good stuff.
Thank you very much for reaching out.
Of course. Every episode of Popcast at nytimes.com/popcast. Popcast Deluxe is on YouTube, youtube.com/popcast. That's me and Joe every week in the chairs with the snacks. tinyurl.com/popcast Discord or Popcast Facebook. That's where the fan communities are, Discord and Facebook. Get in them. Email me at popcast@nytimes.com with any questions. We're going to have a mailbag episode coming up soon, so get in on that. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio or audiovisual content. That's Spotify, that's Apple, that is YouTube, etc., etc. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. You Ain't Much Fun. I guess he thought it was funny, but I sobered up. I got to thinking, girl, you ain't much fun since I quit drinking. Now I'm painting the house and I'm mending the fence. I guess I gone and lost all my good sense. Too much work, it's hard for your health.